and welcome to Worlds Apart. As the age of American dominance draws to a close, developing a peer relationship with Washington becomes both an enculturation challenge and an opportunity for a more peaceful and predictable world. What does it take to hold your own vis-a-vis the aging superpower? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Samir Saran, president of the Observer Research Foundation in India. Mr. Saran, it's a great privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time and welcome to Moscow.
Well, thank you for having me, Oksana.
Now, we are recording this interview as the United States and Iran are trying to finalize their peace deal, but many analysts have already characterized this conflict as the end of the era of unchallenged U.S. dominance. Do you agree with that, that Washington has been served humble pie?
You know, I would argue that the end of unipolarity, the end of the American world, Pax Americana, was 2007-8, the financial crisis. After that, I don't think America has held the same kind of influence and clout to be able to shape global outcomes. We have seen that America has the capacity to destroy. It has the capacity to bomb countries to stone age. But it does not have the positive capacity to create solutions, to build coalitions.
Absolutely. But even this capacity to bomb a country into a stone age, I think, has been challenged recently, has it not?
I don't think that capacity has been challenged. I think that what has been challenged by Iran is the capacity of America to prevail in a conflict. While the Americans have, of course, inflicted terrible damage to the Iranians, let there be no doubt about
it. And sustained significant damage to themselves.
And lost a lot of their own pieces of equipment as well as human lives. What is clearly surfaced in the recent conflict is the lack of compellence. America cannot compel countries to behave in certain ways anymore. And that was a true marker of a hegemon or a superpower when you could compel and you could enforce outcomes. America can't do that anymore.
Now, I think this conflict also demonstrated not only the major lapses in the U.S. strategic and operational thinking, but also in basic preparedness. The Americans have burned through their long-range missiles, their air defense munitions very quickly, and their ability to wage a conflict in a successful manner, even against the mid-sized country, I think it's highly questionable at this point of time. Now, the question to you is, what does it mean for power relations in the world and especially in Asia?
If you are sitting in a Western capital today, you need to ask yourself that is your military industrial complex capable of sustaining a long conflict, even with a medium-sized power? If you think about it, Russia has in the last few years been able to produce, sometimes outproduce, the collective strength of the European Union and the American, the United States of America in terms of defense production for some of the key munitions that are required in the conduct of a conflict. I think the West was found wanting. I'm just imagining that if the conflict was not with Iran, if it was with the Chinese, or if it was with a stronger opponent, what would the outcome be? And I think it is certainly something that requires planners to go back to the design board. Now, what does it mean for others? I think there's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity, to be able to meet the gaps that exist in the global defense landscape. Many countries are doing that. I mean, look, the Indians have realized that we will need to invest in our own defense. We will need to build our own frameworks. We will need to produce locally. So you have seen India's manufacturing, certainly in the defense sector, explode exponentially. We are now exporters of defense equipment around the world. So you are seeing countries in Asia and the emerging world beginning to realize that you have to do it yourself.
Now, I would venture to add to what you just said, that the gaps are not only in the industrial capacity to produce, but also perhaps in the psychological, strategic, and mental fortitude. Being able to predict outcomes and plan various scenarios. And that's where it seems that the American had a major blind spot. Now, I think many countries, both American allies and adversaries at this point, are planning or trying to reassess their relationship with the United States and perhaps make it a little bit more balanced. And it occurred to me that India's own recent experience of falling out with the United States may be quite helpful. The way your nation faced and dealt with American entitlements can offer some interesting insights on how to deal with Americans going forward. What do you think?
You know, first on the previous point you made, you know, we had during the Raisina Dialogue, which I host every year in New Delhi, we had the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister participate this year. And he made an interesting statement, which remains with me. He said, Americans play football, we play chess. And in some sense, there is also a difference in approach. I'm not saying what is right, what is wrong. All I'm saying is that the world operates under different social, you know, psychological and sociological.
Absolutely, but I would assume that in a country of any significance, you would want a combination of physical military capacity, but also the ability to
the thinking. Yeah. No, you are right. Look, I think it is very hard to not agree, even if you are a supporter of America, that they bungled up. That this was something that was reeking of bad planning. It was, you know, at the very least, if you're very kind to them, it was bad planning. And if you are truly honest, it was bad planning, bad implementation, bad strategic thinking, and clearly you were unprepared. You know,
was it one example of bad implementation, strategic thinking, etc., or was it sort of a systematic lapse in applying your force?
I think, to be honest, this lapse was very visible in the Biden presidency during the exit from Afghanistan, how badly prepared they were. And I think it is more systemic. I think that is reflected even in the current operations. So I'm not sure that this is a one-off. I think there is a deeper melee that you know, the American planners will have to respond to. But however, I think your other question, India dealing with the U.S. Look, U.S. is a friendly country to India. We are friends. We have millions of Indians who have built their lives there and built bridges between the two countries. Let's not over-romanticize that. They are Americans. They work for America. They make value in America. They live in America. But because of their familiarity with India, they created these economic and socio-cultural linkages between the countries. So that was one of the factors. We have lots of Indian leadership, both business and political, who have studied in America, who have invested part of their lives in America, and they've returned to India and are running and managing their businesses and political lives in India. We have industries that have deep linkages across from Silicon Valley to Bangalore, and of course from the manufacturing landscapes in Middle America to Middle India. So we have all of that. I mean, Apple produces the largest amount of its American iPhone requirement out of India now, right? They moved from China to India a few years ago. So we have a deep linkage with the American state, but we have a hostile White House. And that is the duality of the relationship.
But exactly, this is exactly what I'm asking you about, because dealing with the American political leadership is a challenge in and of itself. There may be people-to-people relations. There may be ties with corporate America. But, you know, this aggrandizement, arrogance, entitlement, it comes, you know, from the top of the political power. And ultimately, it distorts the whole system of relationship, whether on the bilateral basis or, you know, the international system as such. So I'm asking you again specifically about how the political Indian leadership decided to deal with what is essentially a psychological and political problem.
Look, the political Indian leadership is very wise. I think Prime Minister Modi has so much experience leading governments, first in the state and now the country. So many years of experience. He's going to be celebrating 25 years this year as the head of a government, either in a province or as a national leader. He has, in my view, and this, it's not something he has said or I am privy to, in my assessment, he is now convinced that if we have to have a relationship with America, we need to wait out this White House. In many ways, you have decided that this White House is going to not necessarily result in anything significant in terms of building the relationship. What leaders like him probably have to now take a call on is that do you defend what exists or do you bail out? And I think that's the big question for most countries.
If you're biding time, you need to be biding time for something else. But if it's a systemic problem,
no, I don't think they are biding time. They are waiting him out.
What are you waiting for?
I don't think there is any biding time here. And I don't think anyone... See, look, you have to understand. India is not a Japan that is dependent on America for a number of its essential existential questions. We are not a lapdog partner of America in Europe. We are a sovereign country that built its security, strategy, and economy with an America that was inimical to us. The America was against India.
You can develop and exist without them.
Correct. We have built our political and economic muscles with an antagonistic America.
Absolutely. Right? But Mr. Samir, what are you then?
Therefore, for us, America is now in many ways a tactical opportunity. It is by far the largest technological giant in the world. And it is linked to our technology futures quite deeply. Are they going to share with us the crown jewels of their technology? No, they're not. But what it allows us, what that ecosystem of research that we are integrated into allows us is to build our own capabilities, like we have done in the last 10 to 15 years. So America, the American political leadership must not come in the way of the American opportunity that that we essentially require to grow. Similarly, India has been very, very clear, even in its formative years, that even as we create an autonomy of choice, autonomy of science, autonomy in economy, autonomy in our defense, our partnerships continue to be invested into. We build partnerships with the whole world. And I think that is exactly what we're doing. When we say wait him out, it doesn't mean that I'm going to see a rainbow at the end of the tunnel. I'm not saying that the next American
Absolutely,
president
but
is
I'm
going to come.
What kind of a partner you're waiting for, and is that kind of a partnership?
We are not waiting for anything. We should stop waiting for anything. Trumpism is going to survive Trump. Trump has upset the international dimension so dramatically that I think at least for a decade, no American president is going to be able to shift the needle dramatically. So anyone who's waiting for euphoric moment post Donald Trump.
Okay, non-euphoric. Realistically speaking, what would be the best or, you know, a good case scenario for somebody, for a good leader or for a good sort of format of the Indian-American political relationship?
No, look, now let's be honest here. Right now, we have the U.S. Trade rep in India as we speak. They are looking to sign an agreement in the coming days. We will possibly get into a significant trade arrangement with them in the coming days. That's good for both countries.
You
that's
already have everything you are actually waiting for.
No, that's not true. We are growing. We have to move from $4 trillion to $10 trillion in the next 10 years, which means my relationship with certain countries has to become $500, $600, and $700 billion in size. So that's not true. If I have to reach that level of trade with the European Union, I had to sign the FTA. Let me complete my point. If we have to reach a level of trade with Europe, which is €500 to €600 to €700 billion, we have to sign that FTA, which we have done last year. If I have to reach the $500 to $600 to $700 billion trading relationship with the Americans, we have to sign some sort of an arrangement that allows us to catalyze and grow. It's the same thing that we have done with the Gulf. And of course, at some point, when relationships become better and we don't have political acrimony, we'll have to also think about how do we integrate deeper with the Chinese in growing that relationship. India will have four large essential economic ties: the US, the EU, the Chinese, and the Gulf. Between these four lies the growth geographies, right? And of course, as a investor in the bilateral with Russia, I hope that we can take this momentum of the last 3-4 years where we have increased the commodity trade between us tremendously and make it into a permanent new relationship where we can become Russia's most preferred trading partner. But I think the reality here is that I am not looking for American defense. I'm not looking for their protection. I'm not looking for their patronage. I am seeking opportunities like they are seeking opportunities with us. We are today in a more transactional phase, and I think the romanticism around our relationship is over. We are both transactional, we are tactical, and we are seeking opportunities from each other.
Okay, well, Mr. Saran, what I'm seeking right now is to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I've spent years in conversations beyond borders. Some were formal, some tense, some difficult. But all of them mattered. They charted India's path and how the world responded. Foreign policy isn't theory, it is lived. In arguments, in decisions, and in their consequences. It's not an interview, it's a conversation. Let's talk.
J'ai déjà été bombardé ce matin. On est dans le district de Petrovski, à Donetsk. C'est pour l'instant réfugié dans un magasin, mais ça continue de bombarder partout autour. Panel possible. Kiri, Grad.
No freedom of expression at the level of a right to be informed.
Weil wenn Sie ja heute für vielleicht allein das Wort Russland oder eine pro-russische Haltung einnehmen, ist das heute schon eine Straftat.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Samir Saran, president of the Observer Research Foundation in India. Mr. Saran, I understood from our dialogue before the break is that your main foreign policy objective for the United States is simply, you know, watch out for the subterfuge and the, you know, political barriers on the way of what's already coming. You know, the economic cooperation is already having its own momentum, and the big goal here is just to, you know, prevent obstacles from it. But I also heard you say that the United States, the Americans simply don't have experience of relating to other nations, particularly friendly nations, as equal partners. Mm-hmm. What do you think will it take to teach Washington that skill? And do you think they're interested in acquiring one?
Look, I think we should not get into the business of teaching Washington anything. What we have to invest in is understanding the boundaries within which we have to engage with Washington. I think that is what is required as a sovereign state. We should not have an illusion about what we can achieve, and nor should we not be optimistic about maximizing the possibilities. What we were discussing before we went to the break was that how do we prevent the White House from becoming an obstacle in the business-to-business, people-to-people, society-to-society ties that are already strong between India and the US. And as India grows, they are expected to offer opportunities for both countries, by the way. Now, I think, as far as I am concerned, there is the big question that America faces, that in a world where there are many other emerging powers, some of them are going to become significantly large in size. We are going to be bigger than the American economy in this century, in the next 20, 25, 30 years, right? They have to ask themselves that how can they form a friendly relationship with a country that does not see itself smaller than them, that does not see itself subservient to them, that does not see itself subordinate to them.
Let me quote you here, because I really like this phrase from one of your articles, that until Washington accepts that India is an ancient nation with its own immutable timeline and unalterable threat calculus, and not a junior supplicant seeking admission to some charm circle, the relationship will oscillate between promise and frustration. And I think holding space for your partner's immutable timeline and unalterable threat calculus, mm-hmm. you know, it takes a lot of geopolitical maturity. Ultimately, that's the difference between a child and an adult psychological level. And I think the problem up until recently has been that the Americans have no incentives of being adults in the international system when everybody caters to them. Now, is it something that would require... obviously, I think it would require some change on the part of American thinking, but I wonder how the international system and other countries need to change that posture in order to enable all of us the kind of, level playing field that we all aspire to at conferences like this, but unfortunately, it's still not a livable geopolitical reality.
Look, I think it is now becoming evident to the world that if you have to deal with America, you have to deal from a space of pride. If the minute they see weakness, they will trample over you. You saw how the Chinese have dealt with the Americans. You've seen how the Indians are managing the Americans. You've seen how the Russians have dealt with
while being Americans. Very courteous at the same time.
You don't have to be rude. You can be polite and you can be strong. And I think that is, by the way, Xi Jinping was also polite and strong. He was also not discourteous. The only person discourteous in international affairs happens to be an American. Everyone else is courteous and polite.
But actually, you know, when you are courteous to somebody else, you are upholding your own values.
It's your own values. That's right. So my point here is that it is very clear to Europeans today that if you have to deal with the Americans, you have to build your own strength and you have to respect yourself. And I am very happy that Meloni, in the recent episode where Donald Trump has refused to back down and has given it back. I am very clear in my own assessment that this is a moment of transformation in Europe. Many European leaders are going to come to the same conclusion that you and I have come to, which is that if you have to deal with the Americans, deal through a reciprocity and through from a place of mutual respect. Americans have not given others the respect that they expect the others to give to them. And my view is that reciprocity has to be the basis of international relationships. Otherwise, we are living in jungle. We are not living in a world of order.
Now, I asked you, and we had a vibrant conversation about India's spat with the Trump administration over tariffs, but I also want to ask you about India taking a stance vis-a-vis the Biden administration at the start of the Ukrainian conflict, where you simply refused to ditch your relationship with Russia because the West demanded you so. I know that most Indian analysts, thinkers, believe that it was the right thing to do, but I wonder if it had any sort of implications beyond India. Do you think other nations took notice? Do you think it moved anything beyond the bilateral relationship between Russia and India or somewhere else?
Look, I have written on this subject. I have spoken on this subject. I have spoken vocally on this subject. I have also spoken in Davos on this very question. And my answer has always been that, look, Russia and India are friends. Friends sometimes make bad decisions. You don't ditch your friends.
I'm
not speaking for Russia. I'm saying, even if you are someone who believes that territorial integrity is inviolable and special operations or military operations should not have been done, even if you belong to that school of thought, the fact here is that our relationship is bigger than an incident in our geopolitical journeys. We have, over time, Russia and India, have made certain choices that are not necessarily consistent with both individual countries' own strategic choices. They've been different. But our relationship is so much deeper. I mean, I tell the Americans that if you want friendship with me, you have violated the sovereignty of every country in the last, you know, in the last 20 years. You have violated more sovereign, spaces than anyone else in this world. How can you expect and choose this as a basis of relationships, right? So my point here is that India chose Russia. India chose its relationship with Russia. India also did not undermine its own position in international law. It continued to urge parties to solve it within the bounds of the charter that we have all signed in the UN Charter, right? So I think there is no contradiction in having deep and loyal and committed friendships with your partner who has supported you through time. Russia has supported us in our weak moments. We are not going to forget that. Even now, so many years since we have had any significant problem in global affairs where we have really needed Russian intervention. Even now, if you ask a 25-year-old Indian that who are your most trusted partners, Russia will be at top. ORF does this every year. And Russia comes amongst the top two or three. This year, perhaps it's number one. But, it is always in the 75% to 80% range or 70% to 80% range.
What I'm hearing you say is that principles matter, but relationship matter too, and you cannot blackmail one nation.
No, relationship is a principle. That's what I'm trying to tell the world. That when you choose a person, it is a principle that you have made a choice and you have to stand by it. Sometimes your friends will put you in uncomfortable positions, but that does not mean that you've not principally chosen to be with that person. So I think international relations are, of course, based on personalities. They are based on friendships, but they are largely defined by principles. And choosing friends is also a principled decision.
Now, I've heard you use the example of BrahMos missiles developed by Russia and India, jointly manufactured by India, purchased by the Philippines, perhaps with the help of American financing, to defend against Russia's closest partner, China, as the example of both working relationships on many fronts and also as a sort of a model for multifaceted, flexible cooperation of the future.
Correct.
Do you think that's going to be more a rule or more an exception?
Because India and Russia relationship is an exception. What India and Russia share is exceptional. You could have your biggest trading relationship with China. You could say they are your BFFs in international relations, your best friends. But understand, we are your most special friends. You could have the best friends and you could have the most important trading relationships with anyone else in the world. But when it comes to that special relationship that India and Russia share, it is exceptional. What we do, no other relationship will do. I'm not saying we are the biggest. I'm not saying we are the most dominant. I'm not saying we are the most strategically important. But we are the most special relationship that exists today in international relations. The India-Russia. People don't get it. People just don't understand why. What is it that Russia brings on the table for the Indians? Or what is it that we bring on the table for the Russians? But the reality is that we have grown up together. In our adulthood, we may have separate circles. But our childhood, our foundations are the same. We grow out of the same foundations. And therefore, we are each other's back. I always tell my Russian colleagues that, listen, you have new opportunities, but those new opportunities will be served well if I have your back. I have new opportunities, and they will be served well if you have my back. So I think what you and I do together, whether it's BrahMos or anything else, is exceptional. It is not the norm.
Well, I think we are also talking here about trust, and trust is such a sort of bandied about word that people don't understand that it actually takes a lot of effort, a lot of geopolitical sacrifice sometimes to sustain and maintain it. And my, I guess, last question to you in this situational partnerships that many analysts believe will characterize the new international system, do you think trust building, not just trust, but trust building will have any purchase? Do you think countries can see the value of investing and sacrificing in order to cultivate something like that?
You know, I wrote an article a few months ago, and in which I concluded that in a world where everything is transactional, everything has a price, everything is weaponized, eventually the differentiator will be the trust factor. If you look at, and I gave the example of a few countries. For example, let's take the example of UAE. UAE is now building that relationship with the individuals. Earlier it used to be fly by Dubai. Then it said fly by Dubai. Now it says fly by and live in Dubai. You know, they are actually building a relationship, a special bond of empathy, of connection with the people, the way they have served the large Indian population in that country as their own. When the pandemic hit, when the current drone strikes were happening, they have looked after everyone living in that city as their own. It's the trust that matters eventually. Countries trust each other. We trust the Russians. We trust the Emiratis. We, therefore, will walk miles with them. We will run marathons with them. We will create crazy new fun architectures with them that will shape the future. Everything else is LLMs. What is human is the trust factor.
Well, Mr. Samir, I don't think there is a better ending to this interview. Thank you very much for being with us today and sharing your insights.
Thank you, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. See you next week on Worlds Apart.